duplicate what Cuba has done, we can certainly borrow ideas. And just like, what do we say, all politics are local, all healthcare is local, and we can use some of their ideas in our counties, for example, to expand our county health departments, to work them more closely with primary care doctors, train enough doctors so that they can actually make house calls again. This is an important part of what the Cuban system does. We just need to be open to good ideas, and they have lots of good ideas.
Well, great. Thank you. We've been talking with Mike Huntington, and earlier we talked with John Waller about Cuban's national health care system and what the U.S. has to learn from it. That's a public forum that's going to be on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. at the Albina Library. Mike, thanks for joining us on Radio Zine today on KBOO.
You're welcome, Emma. Glad to take part of this.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Queery every third Saturday at 10 p.m.
The things we could do, oh, it takes my breath away.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning we have two recent Criterion DVDs, but first, here's Jeff Godsell on the controversial Eddington.
Ari Aster's new film, Eddington, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Pedro Pascal, Emma Stone, and Austin Butler, opened nationwide on Friday, July 18th.
Give me a home where the buffalo roam.
Is that praying?
Where the deer and the antelope play.
Oh, how did we get here? And even worse, is it worth it?
Where seldom is
at the cost of being at war with your neighbors?
The discouraging word.
That's why I'm running for mayor.
And the skies are not
mayor of Eddington. Thank you super duper very much. I used to think that you were some big deal, but I am a much better human being than you.
Who are you talking to? There's nobody here.
If there's one thing I can say definitely about the film, it's that how much you will like it will depend on how much you like Ari Aster's films at all. As one who was firmly in his camp, I can say that I loved it and that it may be his best. After only four feature films, Hereditary, Midsommar, Beau Is Afraid, and now Eddington, it is undeniable that, not unlike the work of his contemporaries like Wes Anderson or Yorgos Lanthimos, Aster's films are journeys into a unique world and into his own head. And not everyone will enjoy or be up to the challenge of figuring out what's going on in there. But no one can deny that he's become a master of the tools he uses to convey this world. Eddington is not without a story, not without a plot, far from it. But to focus too much on it would be to misrepresent the pleasures and the frustrations sometimes at the same time, of the film itself. Nevertheless, I will touch down on the key plot points as points of reference, always keeping in mind to avoid any spoilers. Joaquin Phoenix plays Joe Cross, the sheriff of small town Eddington, New Mexico. Joe seems like a good guy, likable guy, even-tempered, but he doesn't see eye to eye with the mayor of the town, Ted Garcia, played by Pedro Pascal, who happens to be running for re-election. We learn later that there may be some past grievances regarding Garcia and Joe's wife, Louise, played by a sad Emma Stone. Ted is also supportive of the efforts of a large tech data center being built in the town, presumably helping the town to prosper. Things only get worse when, as this is the COVID summer of 2020, the two of them find themselves on opposite sides of the great to wear or not to wear a mask issue. As their animosity grows, Cross decides to actually run against Garcia for mayor. To add to the tension in the town, soon comes the George Floyd killing and the Black Lives Matter protests. And soon the small town of Eddington starts to exemplify and mirror all of the crises of the entire country at the time. Suffice to say that things escalate dramatically, resulting in murder and much mayhem. To describe the plot anymore would, as I said, provide too many spoilers as well as be a disservice to the film, I think. For if Eddington is about anything at all, it's about feelings, or more precisely, the anxieties about feelings. Not since Roman Polanski as a director been so captivated by anxiety and dread. And placing the film in that dark time of COVID and the BLM protests only heightens the feelings of uncertainty. But to describe Eddington as a film of frustrations and turmoil would be to obscure the hidden truth that the film is very, very funny. Sometimes laughter comes as an antidote to tension, but more often just as a reaction to watching poor Joe Cross navigate through his dilemmas. With Bo is Afraid and now Eddington, Joaquin Phoenix appears to be the quintessential Ari Aster protagonist. He may gain our sympathy at times as his travails and predicaments increase, but he is no mere victim. Far from it. In fact, one's feelings about so many of the characters in Aster's films remain complicated. And don't make the mistake of thinking that the film is really about the pandemic and the protests of the COVID era. Aster originally had the idea for Eddington, or some kind of Western, to be his first feature as early as 2017. And while he gives ample screen time to characters spouting their attitudes and platitudes, including the usual woke nonsense, which I found extremely amusing, as did many others at the screening that I attended, it merely adds to the overall atmosphere of confusion. Some early reviews of the film have decided that by featuring the polarization of the populace so prominently as he does, that Aster and the film should be faulted for not offering solutions, or at least making his own point of view clear. I think this is a clear case of badly missing the point. The world of Ari Aster's films reflects the world as he sees it, or better said, as he feels it. It is a world of tensions, unease, awkwardness, and discomfort, and a great deal of humor. It may not be your world, or one that even you care to visit. But it's an authentic one, from a true artist at the top of his game. And you may not find the key that opens the door that explains just what he's on about at every juncture. I'm still somewhat puzzled about the Austin Butler character, a charismatic and slippery TV evangelist type who lures Emma Stone away to join his cult. But similar to watching the films of Antonioni or Buñuel, this bewilderment is not enough to detract from the overall experience. It can't even be considered a quibble. I just figure it's not him, it's me. A24 has put a lot of marketing efforts into this film, and whether it will pay off at the box office remains to be seen. My personal feeling is that it will not, because it's still very much an Ari Aster film, and coming in at 2.5 hours long, it's still a tough sell to the masses. But as films like Poor Things have shown, there's still a place for challenging, inventive films, even leading to Oscars. And I would have no problem seeing Joaquin Phoenix get his second. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. But don't go away. Here's Jeff again on an overlooked film noir from 1951.
This is Dick Powell. Let me tell you about the leading character in Cry Danger. His name is Rocky Malloy, and I like him. Why? Well, he's got a knack of getting into trouble. A lot of trouble. Dangerous trouble. Danger comes to him like an old friend about to make a touch.
Doing research into the films of 1951 has revealed all kinds of unexpected pleasures, especially in the film noir category. These were the kind of movies that were shown on local television late at night when I was a kid. Considered lesser products then and now, they actually look better with age. What they lack in prestige and budget, they can make up for in grit and creativity. By the early 50s, location shooting had become more common in Hollywood. It was cheap and easy to hit the streets. It was a great boon to the independents, freed from the constraints of the studio system. Even the studios themselves were taking advantage of it. And no genre was served better than the film noir crime thriller. Films like Mystery Street, He Ran All the Way, The Raging Tide, and a little gem called Cry Danger. By 1951, Dick Powell had long since transformed himself from the baby-faced crooner of 30s musicals like Footlight Parade into the serious actor of the 40s and beyond, thanks to Murder, My Sweet, 1944, which incidentally made him the first person to portray Philip Marlowe on the screen. For Cry Danger, Powell plays an ex-con, pardoned from prison and determined to answer the lingering questions that remain about the caper that got him sent up. Questions like, what happened to the money? Everybody's cracking wise in this one, and it's really a lot of fun to listen to the dialogue. It always stays just this side of parody. It never quite falls into the Dragnet-style shtick. There's an able supporting cast headed by Rhonda Fleming and such stalwarts as William Conrad and Regis Toomey. Oscar-winning editor Robert Parrish moved up to the director's chair for this one, and behind the camera was veteran Joseph Bayrock. All going to show that some of the movies with the lowest budgets were not made by only second-rate talents. All the good ones knew that work is work and that every film can give you the opportunity to shine. Often their work was appreciated within the industry, if not recognized by the general public. I'm thinking of the work of composers like Bernard Herrmann, art directors like William Cameron Menzies, cinematographers like James Wong Howe, who did such great work on the aforementioned He Ran All the Way with John Garfield. It's as if working without the stink of importance, everyone was free to just get on with it, displaying their craft, exploring their creativity, and solving technical problems, all just to tell a good story. That is, if the script didn't let you down. And maybe the real star of Cry Danger is the city of Los Angeles itself. Shots of Bunker Hill and Chinatown in 1951 are priceless. This no doubt helped the film get restored in 2011 by the UCLA Film and TV Archive. And it is that print that I was able to get on a cheap DVD. It's also the one that you could probably find on YouTube. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Jeff. And you're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And here's a special announcement. Look for a special screening event from hosts the Portland Critics Association to be held at the Hollywood Theater coming this November. The PCA is a group of local movie reviewers that dispenses Best of the Year awards, hosts screenings, and stages educational events. Go to portlandcritics.com for more information, including previous annual best film lists.
And now here's Doug with a review of the recent Criterion release of Jean Eustache's 1973 feature, The Mother and the Whore.
Je suis persuadé que tout ce qui est arrivé dans le monde ces dernières années est totalement dirigé contre moi. Il y a eu la révolution culturelle, mai 68, les Rolling Stones, les cheveux longs, les Black Panthers, les Palestiniens, l'Underground, et depuis 2-3 ans, plus rien.
Death permeates the mother and the whore and a myriad of mysterious ways. Some of the participants committed suicide after completion of the shoot, and the director himself, Jean Eustache, committed suicide in 1981. A few years after the film's release, when he was despondent after an accident affected his body integrity. Most important of all the mother and the whore moments of death is that of idealism and social change among the Parisian intelligentsia. The film is set within the Paris of its time and focuses on a handful of people, all of whom, presumably, participated in the events of May 1968. When students joined workers in protest. At first, the main character, Alexandre, played by Jean-Pierre Lode, also signals that the movie is a post-New Wave film, or possibly an announcement of the death of the once vital New Wave movement from the late 50s through, say, 1964. A man of, as they say, no visible means of support, unless it is through his girlfriend Marie, played by Bernadette Lafont, who owns a small dress shop. For when not with her, Alexandre is out and about, not unlike men in the François Truffaut film. Here, he is first seen trying to reignite a romance with a previous girlfriend, then picking up any other woman who seems willing. One who particularly attracts his attention is a young Polish woman, Veronica, played by Françoise Lebrun, who works in a hospital, and her appeal partially enforced due to her resemblance to the previous ex-girlfriend who has rejected him yet again. You wouldn't know when you started watching the film, but The Mother and the Whore came in a detailed script from which Eustache privileged no deviation. Rather, it comes across as improvised, like a John Cassavetes film. And, to a certain frame of mind, the 4 hours of talk among the threesome is fascinating and real. As the brochure notes, quote, Eustache came from a working-class background in southwestern France. Trained as an electrician, and after moving to Paris, worked for the railways, but he became a regular at the Cinémathèque Française, and his wife got a job as secretary at Cahiers du Cinéma. So he was able to enter that milieu. In 1972, he received funding to make a feature, thanks to his producer friend, Pierre Coutrel, who got it from Bob Rafelson after his enormous success with Easy Rider, close quote. Labeled spine number 1245, The Mother and the Whore comes in a new 4K digital restoration with uncompressed monaural soundtrack, one 4K UHD disc of the film, and one Blu-ray with the film and the special features, with supplements including a new interview with actor François Lebrun and a 30-minute conversation between filmmaker Jean-Pierre Gorin and everyone's favorite novelist, Rachel Kushner, who has enough of a European hint to many of her books. They both reminisce about the impact of the film on their lives and sensibilities and grapple with its lingering hues of death.
The time I saw it was in 1997 when it screened at Film Forum in New York City. I didn't understand any of the backstory. I didn't know who Eustache was. I didn't understand anything about May 68. But the film produced this significant effect on me, and I can still feel that effect when I watch it now. He has the capacity, the talent, on term to use, to drain away every place where you try to hide an optimistic meaning. But it's not a nihilistic film, I think, because there's this sense of keening desire on his part to find a way to live that is true to some ideal that he upholds.
Also included is an account of the film's restoration and a segment from the French television series Pour le Cinéma, featuring Lebrun, Eustache, Lafont, and Layoud. Finally, there is the film's trailer, new English subtitles, and in the accompanying booklet, along with the cast, crew, and transfer info, is an essay by the critic Lucy Sante and an introduction to the film by Eustache. Sante writes, quote, "In Marie's apartment after sex, he tells Veronica about a cafe that opens at 5:25 in the morning, where you meet the most extraordinary characters. Instead of a cut to a scene in that cafe, though, Alexander continues his description, including of the day that he walked into the cafe and everyone was weeping. It was May 68 and the police had just thrown in a canister of tear gas." That is the film's only extended allusion to May 68, Sante goes on, but that period and its aftermath hang over the movie like a lowering cloud. You can assume that Alexander and Marie were at least in the streets then, although maybe more as spectators than activists. Veronica, who is not French and not bourgeois, brings reality back to the table, reminding everybody that the personal is political. A key focus of May 68 was the politics of daily life, although the French left was inclined to let that part slide after women started claiming it, close quote. Later in the middle of his essay, Ms. Sante honors the film's curious shift of central characters from Alexandre to Veronica, writing, quote, "She has been through a great deal at the hands of men. She is a beautiful Polish nurse who lives in a small room in the hospital, who drinks too much, who has seen it all and is resignedly acquiescent, but who somehow, underneath, remains a romantic. Unlike the other characters, who are clearly middle class and, especially the men, educated to the point of pedantry, Veronica is a working class immigrant who doesn't read, doesn't tailor her speech, and loves slang," which, by the way, got the film in trouble with the censors, perhaps immoderately. But both couples use the formal vous with one another, employing tu with everyone else, and Marie and Veronica with each other. That imbues their exchanges, which can range from playful to sordid, with the courtliness of the classics of infidelity by Beaumarchais or Clodoreau de la Close, close quote. And that is but a brief example from one of the best and most informative of all of Criterion's pamphlet inserts.
Also just out from Criterion is the 1950 Western, directed by Anthony Mann and starring James Stewart, Winchester 73.
To seven people, this gun was a magnet, a treasure, a weapon that promised life and dealt out death. For this saga of the West, Universal International has assembled a matchless cast. James Stewart, whose personal feud led to one of the grimmest manhunts ever filmed. Shelley Winters, trigger sharp and dangerous in her own way. Dan Duryea as vicious Waco Johnny Dean, who killed to get the gun. Stephen McNally, brutal, deadly, who wanted the rifle to slaughter men.
I was surprised to see, as the Criterion DVD of Winchester 73 began to spin, that the film is in black and white. I could have sworn it was color. And indeed, as I continued on to watch the film, I began to wonder if I had ever even seen it in the first place. I thought I'd caught up with all the Anthony Mann westerns. Mann was one of the most conspicuously talented genre specialists in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s, and he was especially good with film noir subjects, especially when his cinematographer was John Alton. With Winchester 73, Mann introduced a series of so-called adult westerns, many of them in collaboration with James Stewart, but also some were made with the likes of Gary Cooper or even Barbara Stanwyck. Most of his Western films were in color, while mostly switching from thrillers to Westerns, the reverse of Elmore Leonard's trajectory at the same time. The Furies, also from the Criterion Collection is probably his breakthrough Western in that it is psychologically acute from most other Westerns of the time, showing the influence, usually dire, of Freudianism on American popular culture and its manufacturers. But his first foray into psychological complexity begins with Winchester 73, and the black and white, it turns out, suits the hard-edged, abrasive, unsettling nature of the characters involved in the long-running cross-country fight to keep the much-treasured Winchester rifle that has a talismanic perfection as a weapon of death to victims and owners alike. Stewart's character wins the gun in a contest, but then it is stolen by the violent yet equally obsessive character played by Stephen McNally. Soon the rifle ends up in the hands of Dan Duryea's character, one of man's more obnoxious villain characters who disrupts any social circle he invades. Also along for the journey is Shelley Winters as a woman right out of town. There's a touching, almost inside joke when James Stewart gives her a pistol in anticipation of a soon-to-come Indian attack, and she inspects the chamber and looks up, says, "I know what the last bullet is for." The moment harks back to Ford's Stagecoach. Also in the cast is Rugg Hudson as a malevolent Native American and Tony Curtis as an impossibly beautiful cavalry troop. Though the two actors don't inhabit the same frame, they do cohabitate in a universe in which the studio marbled its many productions with gifted performers, obviously on the rise. The subject of Native Americans and their portrayal in Hollywood is introduced by film programmer Adam Piron in a thorough discussion on the disc in one of its many supplements. He tracks back the actual ethereality of, quote, Indians, close quote, from the mislabeling in the colonial days to early silence by indigenous people in reaction to Western shows. Man was more respectful to that populace than most of his contemporaries. Also in the disc is a new 4K digital restoration undertaken by Universal Pictures in collaboration with the Film Foundation, as the brochure indicates, with uncompressed monaural soundtrack, one 4K UHD disc of the film and one Blu-ray with the film and special features, an audio commentary track featuring actor James Stewart, culled from a much earlier laser disc of the film with film historian Paul Lindenschmidt, in which Stewart proves to be insightful about his character in a way that suggests one of those all-too-rare Marshall McLuhan Fielding Mellish moments. Also in hand is Forces of Nature, Anthony Mann at Universal, a biography in video form that charts the man's unexpectedly interesting life and pays particular attention to Winchester 73 and the following Westerns and other films he made in collaboration with James Stewart. It is packed with information otherwise difficult to access. Also on hand are the Lux Radio Theater adaptation of the film from 1951, also starring James Stewart and Stephen McNally. The trailer, English subtitles for the deaf and hard of hearing, and in the accompanying book with cast, crew, and transfer notes, an essay by critic Imogene Sarah Smith, in which she writes, quote, "Though leavened with humor and regular jolts of excitement, the first Mann-Stewart outing introduces somber themes that would return in The Naked Spur and The Man from Laramie. In each of these films, Stewart plays a man scarred by a primal experience of loss and betrayal on an obsessive quest to right some irreversible wrong, imagining that vengeance will make him whole again. The actor brings to these stories a quality that would reach its neurotic pinnacle in Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, a tormented zeal to restore or repair the past. A realization that this is impossible brings a burnt-out bitterness to the long-sought settling of scores, leaving the victor both disappointed and soiled. A feeling that subtly shades the ending of Winchester 73 and darkens in the later Mann Stewart films. Close quote. Once again, this disc is a reminder that when the Criterion Collection cooks with excellent supplements, they create a complete cinema education in a jewel box. Thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.